Welcome to Season 3 of The Broken Banquet. Ashley's settled in Houston. I'm still in Costa Rica. But we're both really excited about bringing you more conversations about missions. We hope you'll enjoy this episode. Hey, Ashley.
How art thou?
I'm fine. It's October.
Really? Oh, okay.
I've been back in the country for a few days, leaving again in 2 days. We've been gone for a week, then back for a few days, then gone again for a few days. It's that time of the year. I had a great visit to Maryland last weekend. It was nice to... It was a church that's been working with us for a really long time, and it just never has worked out for me to visit them. So it finally worked out, and I was there for World Communion Sunday, which is always...
I was going to say pause there. No, just pause there, because you were there for World Communion Sunday, and you were preaching. And, Will, I kid you not, I was preaching on World Communion Sunday as well, and our sermons were almost identical.
Well, I'm surprised that you're surprised. Like, I mean, I feel like, you know, that's sort of to be expected, that we're both going to talk about abiding. We're both going to talk about being invited to the same table. We're both going to talk about, you know, no power, privilege, or preference at that table. That kind of stuff.
I mean, exactly the same. It's like we're the same person, except for I have this happy, joyful, like, excitement in my voice, and you sound a little sad today.
Oh, here we go. You're, yep, the happy, joyful, approachable one, and I'm the grumpy whatever. I'm just tired. That's all. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to see you. I'm happy to see our guest. I'm happy to record another episode. I'm just tired.
I get it.
Yeah.
I've had a little cold, so if you hear me cough from time to time, or this like deeper little baritone-y type voice coming out that makes for good podcasting.
Yeah, you got good radio voice going on today.
Solid.
So are you going to, just to follow with routine, are you going to introduce me to our guest today, or I feel like I should be introducing you to him?
That much is true. I tried to keep this a surprise because I thought, how cool would it have been if you just signed on for the podcast, not looking at our schedule, and then just see our guest and be like, oh my gosh, it's one of my oldest friends.
So look at our schedule, Ashley. Come on. I've never shown up for an interview not knowing who we were talking to today.
Never. That has never happened. Never happened ever.
All right, well, go for it.
Today's guest is someone who has lived and breathed mission from Costa Rica all the way to the United States. Will Faircloth is an old friend of yours. I first heard his name probably 20 years ago when you mentioned it to me. And then I recently heard it from another fellow named Ray Zirkle. And then suddenly, Will and I ended up on a Zoom call together. We were like, hey, I know you. Hey, I know you. And so we started talking. It was really good to get to know him a bit and spend some time on the phone with him and to learn about your two shared history. So I know you guys go way back serving in Costa Rica together, and God's led Will to a new season of ministry here, shaping leaders with Wesleyan Heritage back in the U.S. And so I think that our listeners are really going to love hearing his heart, hearing his story, hearing his vision of where God's moving today. Will, meet Will. Will, meet Will.
It's so nice to meet you, Will Faircloth. I feel like I've seen you somewhere before.
Yeah. It's a pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
So actually, Ashley, Will and I met in the library at Duke Divinity School.
Nice. I forgot you guys went to Duke.
So that was my last year of seminary. It would have been Will's first year of seminary, right? And Will worked in the library. And I was just in the library one day, and we started chatting. And I don't know, somehow I'm sure Costa Rica came up in the conversation, because that's about all I was thinking about during my last year of seminary, because I already knew by that point that I was going to be moving down here. And we got to be friends and actually took a class or two together, I think, our last year. Didn't we take like
Protestantism in Latin America, or Latin American theology, or something like that, with Teresa Breyer?
Something like that. And gosh, you know, I misspelled her name on our, like, whatever our last paper was we had to turn in for that class. So on every single page, and I spelled burger wrong. And so on every single page, she just circled where I had spelled her name wrong. I was so done by that. I mean, that was my last semester, probably my last class.
Oh,
I was done. I was already here. So, yeah, good memories. And I also remember, I can't remember his name, but I can remember distinctly from that class. Of course, we would have these really, as you do in seminary, like really deep conversations about really heavy stuff. And there was one particular gentleman who at the end of every class would raise his hand and say, "So how do I preach that?" And it was so good to have someone kind of reminding us to come back to earth. I've thought about him a lot over the years when I'm preparing messages for folks. But so yeah, anyway,
I have too.
And then Will and his wife Ella came down during our first year here, a team of students from the Divinity School and some undergrads, I think, came down together over spring break maybe. And so Will and his wife came down, and I think that really kind of got the wheels turning, right, for you guys meeting some of the leadership here. And Will, do you want to jump in and kind of tell the rest of your part of that story?
Yeah. I will say you were checked out your last year at Duke, but you were very present. I would find you, you'd have a calling card, and you'd be like on one of the public phones in a hallway somewhere in the div school, and you would have scratched the little calling card off, and you'd be like around the corner trying to have a conversation with Yolanda. I mean, like doing long distance wedding planning and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And we, Ella and I, were actually already booked our honeymoon to Costa Rica. And so you said, well, hey, when y'all are coming down, I'll already be there. Why don't we meet up? So we had dinner with y'all on the night of the day you had your civil wedding ceremony, like where you had gone to get legally married, not your church ceremony, which I think was a couple months later. And then we met with the bishop on the last day of our honeymoon, which you had arranged and is a totally normal thing to do. But that trip, that first Duke trip down to Costa Rica was really key for us, because God had already really put that in our minds. And we thought, let's just kind of go dip our toes in the water. And even though it was your first trip, you were a great host. You had a lot of good work to do. Ugo and all the foremen and all the guys, the church was a great host church. So that really, being in San Ysidro, really made us think, okay, we could do this.
Yeah. And we wound up being neighbors for a number of years. You guys, when you first came down, and you can talk a little bit about the work you were doing with the seminary here, but you were based out of San Ysidro, sort of as a jumping off point for the southern part of Costa Rica. And then at some point, because of the workload I think you had with the seminary, it made sense for you guys to relocate to San Jose. But to have you here for those first few years was wonderful, and to have you as a part of our church community and just as neighbors, as we were both, I think, learning kind of what the heck we were doing.
Yeah, that's true. It really, we had only been married about a year, Elle and I, when we moved down to San Ysidro at the invitation of the Methodist Church of Costa Rica. And I remember y'all were great guides. You were also already very busy very early on, and so you were out of town a lot. And so that left us as kind of only gringos in San Ysidro quite a bit, which was good because we had to learn some stuff ourselves. But you kind of cleared a path for us in many ways. I remember once I had a to-do list for the day, and you and I were having breakfast or something. I showed it to you, and you said, "Oh, yeah, okay, you'll get this done by Friday. Like, you'll be lucky if you get all these items done by the end of the week. Like, time just moves more slowly. There's more friction than you would think." So, yeah, being there those first 2 years with y'all was really key for the rest of our time in Costa Rica.
And it was fun. It was fun for us, too. I think we were fortunate. You know, of course, a lot of missionaries, when they go out into the field, aren't going into a place where there's any sort of familiarity. And so to at least have you all around, so there was that familiarity. We had sort of a shared history from our time in Durham. And of course, you know, both coming from the Southeast in the United States, it probably made some things in the transition easier, I think, for both of us. We've always enjoyed sharing our experiences with other missionaries who have come through Costa Rica over the years and helping them. But I think for us, it was kind of a distraction to some degree of the fact of kind of all the things that I had left behind. Having some of that familiarity now, you know, here around me was probably, I hadn't really thought about it a whole lot, but probably helped my transition. You know, when I first got here, I think the thing I struggled with the most was the combination of how limited my Spanish, I was conversational, but I wasn't fluent. So there was already some communication challenges, but also the things that I had been thinking about very intensely for the last 3 years while we were in seminary were things that I did not know how to talk about in Spanish. And so I had come out of sort of this pressure cooker and was surrounded by people who I was still just getting to know, and I couldn't express myself the way that I really wanted to. And so I think for you to come in and for us to be able to have some of those conversations in English as we were learning how to also little by little have those conversations in Spanish, that was a gift that I think a lot of people probably don't get when they jump into a mission field somewhere where there just isn't anyone else around that's familiar with the context that they came out of.
That's a great point. It was like we both needed a nerd who knew how to say y'all. And we got to be that for each other.
And paraparesis. Like those, you know, you need to be using all of those words.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. That's a good point. It's kind of a good come down, a good softer landing from Duke in such what would have been objectively such a drastic change of setting.
I mean, actually, you're going to have to force your way into this one. So,
well, no, I was just going to let y'all talk all day, catch up, you know.
And then once I remember we were in the jungle.
So talk about some of your experiences in Costa Rica, Will. This is going to be fun. Should I just say double L or one L?
Well,
you know, it's to like make the differentiation.
We did a reverse machismo. I was Will de Ella, Ella's Will, and he was Will de Yola, Yolanda's Will. So it was the men belonging to the women, in a kind of matriarchy setting that most of our friends would. But I was always fine to be Will too.
And then there was another Will that came down here for a while. So we were just the Holy Trinity.
That guy, he was a good water carrier. It was too many Wills. We had, like I said, Ella had always thought about being working in foreign missions. She had taken mission trips to Latin America as a teenager. I mean, she was in Venezuela when she was 13. I grew up as a good United Methodist in Alabama and Mississippi, and we never heard from missionaries. No missionary ever visited. No one talked about missions at all. And so she kind of led on that, our married life was going to need to include some openness to this. And I already spoke Spanish. She spoke French, but picked up Spanish very quickly. And we were 23, barely 24, unencumbered, no kids, no mortgage, no real job prospects. So when the bishop invited us down, we prayed a lot about it, but it wasn't too hard to say yes. We thought it was going to be an initial kind of 2-year term. And the one thing I'll say about San Isidro, it's about 2.5 hours south of San Jose. It was a great first place for us to be, because if you're in a foreign country and you're in the capital, you're more than likely going to see a McDonald's or like an air-conditioned movie theater or just things that make you not feel quite as far from home, but that can be very limiting to your enculturation experience. And so going to San Isidro, where, yes, there was a McDonald's at the time, but that was it. And then working as far south as kind of the Panama border and just being in people's homes, being in people's lives, just living kind of daily reality with all the good and bad, that was a great preparation for when we did move up back to San Jose for a longer stretch, because we always felt like we were country Costa Ricans because we had just, I mean, not nearly as much as Will has, but we'd seen and done things and just been with people and eaten food and had experiences, good and bad, that were just very much part of the non-capital experience. So that was beneficial in hindsight.
And unfortunately, since you've left, now not only do we have a McDonald's, but we've got every other fast food chain and Walmart. And
capitalism. I do remember when they opened the mall. They opened a mall south of town, and even the Costa Ricans called it the small. They knew it was the a small. Yeah.
But it has a Pops in it, which is great.
You do need flavorful ice cream.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Will, will you talk a little bit about what you were invited to do here?
Sure. So when we met with the bishop on the last day of our honeymoon, I'm sure slightly sunburned and a little shot out, he said, okay, you've got one more year of seminary in the States. You already speak Spanish. We really need seminary professors, but for our satellite campuses. So they have the Methodist Church of Costa Rica as a central seminary, but then they have a constellation of kind of satellite campuses. They said the Southern Zone in particular, there's 2 or 3 regional centers. Would you be willing to go down there and live there and travel and teach on weekends, just lay education? And I said, sure. Again, a lot of our story is the Lord keeping things from you so that you won't run away. I mean, just saying yes to the little bit you know, and then later you'll find out what the rest of that means. So that was it. We moved, and then 3 months, he said, I'll give you 3 months and I need you to start teaching. So it was really just in like the kitchen of a local church. I mean, a tin roof, no ceiling, brick walls, kind of fence, windows, teaching Methodist history and doctrine, teaching introduction to the Old Testament, teaching liturgy and worship to literally pineapple farmers, housewives, accountants, mechanics, people who were giving up like maybe the one free day they had a week to come hear a young gringo talk about something that they felt was going to benefit their service to the church. So the sacrifice was a very powerful testimony. And so that's what we did for 2 years. And then there was a need at the central campus in San Jose, and they asked us to move up. And so we eventually we realized we don't call the shots. We're serving at the invitation of the Methodist Church of Costa Rica. So even though we love our life in San Isidro, if the bishop needs us up there, we're going to go up there. We're here to serve. And so we moved and then lived a longer time, and I worked at the main campus.
Will, how would you answer someone who says, you know, why do they need a gringo to come and teach Methodism and doctrine and Old Testament to Costa Ricans? The church has been there for a long time, over 100 congregations nationwide. Surely they're developing leaders. Why the need for a North American seminary grad to come and teach those classes?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I'll say it all goes back to local authority. I mean, the local authority, the Methodist Church of Costa Rica, completely autonomous, run by Costa Ricans, they decided from the mid-90s to the early 2000s that their seminary needed help. It needed kickstarting. They had just founded this seminary in 1990, it was taking about 20 years to develop a homegrown class of pastor professors, Costa Ricans, who could become professors in the seminary. And during that period of growing the church and trying to cultivate these new leaders, you needed some outside help. So there were two or three great Costa Rican professors as well. I mean, at the most, at one point, North American professors were half the faculty, and then it became more Costa Rican. So I'll say after we arrived in 2004, no more North Americans were needed to come down to teach at the seminary. That's not because like we were so good or bad that they just decided to pull the plug, because by 2008, I had former students of mine who were being asked to take on like introduction to theology, or I would hand over, one of my classes. And at the same time, doctoral programs in theology in Latin America were developing. And so we had several of our young Costa Rican leaders go on to get masters and now even PhD degrees in theology, and they're taking over the seminary. So it really was the local leadership seeing a specific need for a specific time and then issuing the invitation. Not so much a gringo saying, I'm going to go be the great white savior. These people really need me to teach them. You know, they already knew everything. They just needed qualified people who weren't already full-time pastors doing 18 different jobs. They needed dedicated faculty. But at this point, there's only one North American left on the faculty of the Methodist Seminary.
Yeah, they stopped asking me a long, long time ago. I think they were relieved when you came around, because, you know, my initial invitation to come here and to be a part of the Methodist Church here included teaching. And I think we all realized pretty quickly that we were so busy right off the bat with hosting teams and with trying to create the infrastructure that the churches here needed so that they could grow, that I just didn't have the time or the bandwidth to also be teaching.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, again, I think we both just serve the local need, you know.
So this is a softball question, and we've asked it a lot early on in the life of this podcast when we were talking to missionaries who were in the field in different places. But what do you came here to teach. I'm curious to know what you think you learned from those who you were sent to teach.
It took me a while to be able to articulate this, but the main thing is just daily dependence on Jesus for almost every aspect of your life. Like, I'm a Costa Rican mom. My kid's got a fever. I'm driving to the pharmacy, hoping they'll be open because I know my kid needs this antibiotics. And it's Jesus, let the pharmacist still be there. Let there not be traffic. I mean, you're just turning that situation over. I'm waiting for the bus to go get a job at a construction site. Please let the bus be on time so that I'm not late, so that the foreman doesn't fire me. you know, I've got trouble with my kids. Jesus, help me with my kids. That we've been back in the States almost 5 years now, and I'm not critical of North American spirituality in any kind of general way, but the amount of buffers there are between your average American, especially kind of white middle-class American in the South, the amount of buffers between that person and just total failure, just total life collapse, there's a lot of buffers. There's a lot of buffers. And I think in a lot of the global South, and at least what we saw in Costa Rica, there aren't as many buffers. Your life could collapse tomorrow based on a sickness or a job loss or something. And you just need Jesus. And so people are just turning that over to Jesus constantly. And there's just this sense of his lordship. Like, he really is in control. So I'm not going to just kind of cross my fingers or thoughts and prayers. Like, I'm actually going to talk to Jesus about this problem in my life. And so I'm still learning that lesson. I feel like that's kind of the main one, is there's just an immediacy of recognizing my need and therefore an immediacy of going to the healer, of going to the Lord.
And I get it. I mean, that's definitely been a part of my experience. And I see that in the community for sure. So I know Ashley's got questions that she wants to ask about what you're doing now.
I just wanted listeners to hear my voice to make sure they knew I was still here. Go ahead. Okay.
Well, but before we get to that, we've talked to a lot of people on here about their transition into the mission field. You may be one of the first people we've talked to that has transitioned out of the mission context in a foreign country back into life in the United States. And I think it'd be really interesting to hear as much of that as you would like to share, what that was like for you and your wife and for your family. What was hard about it? What was great and a relief about it? Like, all those things, because it's a conversation we haven't had yet really on the Broken Banquet.
Definitely. I mean, our transition into Costa Rica in retrospect was almost miraculously easy. I mean, we were, again, very young. We both had traveled abroad together. We both kind of knew each other's quirks. And we both had a lot of, I mean, for as young as we were, we had a good amount of kind of cultural understanding. We already had the language. There wasn't a lot of, I mean, I'm sure there was crazy stuff that my, you know, psyche is blocking out. But in retrospect, it wasn't that crazy of a transition. We didn't have to help children go through culture shock, things like that. So, and then we lived there for 16 years. I mean, from age 24 to 40, it really took me a while after we got back to realize that I didn't know how to be an adult in the United States, because I never had to be. Like, I'd never had paycheck withholdings. I'd never gone to a pediatrician. My father-in-law told me to get the termite bond on our new home checked. I did not know what those words meant. There was just a lot of basic adult stuff about U.S. life that we had never done. So part of it coming back at 40 was just jumping in the deep end with three kids now and in a home and just learning the logistics of daily American life. U.S. healthcare, I mean, you know, the Costa Rican healthcare system's got its problems, but it's so much more accessible. There's so much less gatekeeping than there is in U.S. healthcare. We also came back in December of 2020, which you may recall was not the easiest time politically or epidemiologically. There's a lot going on pre-vaccine, you know, and we were coming back with our kids who had never lived in the States before, one of whom was just 2 years old. So our life was just bigger. There were a lot more moving parts, and the world we were coming into was a little fried, a little crazy. One thing was like family trouble, like, you know, your parents are sick or your sister, you know. But if they were on the other end of a phone call or the other end of a FaceTime call, then you could hang up and you could be just part of Costa Rican life again. But living here was like, okay, well, this is what we came back for. We came back for family, and here we got it with both hands. So kind of integrating ourselves into our broader family's rhythms, you know, which was great, birthday parties, but also like parents getting, you know, lymphoma. And so it's just a lot more immediate because we were so much closer. But that, I mean, at the end of the day, that's what we came back for. Another thing was just sort of money and materialism. And it really took me a couple of years to figure this out as well. We were objectively wealthy in Costa Rica, but we didn't know any rich people, meaning our kind of basic missionary salary set us above most of the people we were serving. But we certainly weren't rich. I mean, Costa Rica has a very wealthy upper class, and it's just kind of growing. You see it more and more. We certainly weren't those people. But then we came back to the States, and we were just kind of middle class West Georgia people. And there were a lot of people my age who had much nicer things than me. And I thought, well, why do they have much nicer things than me if we're the same age? And it took me so long to realize that we were finally around peers. Mm-hmm. Like, Costa Ricans were our brothers and sisters, but they weren't sort of, I don't know, they weren't our peers in any kind of socioeconomic sense. I was never comparing myself to a Costa Rican in socioeconomic terms. But my default when we came back was just to look around at other white dudes and be like, well, he's got a really nice truck and they go on a vacation to France and I'm barely scraping by in this new ministry that actually pays less than we earned when we were missionaries in Costa Rica. So I really had to kind of struggle with the Lord and confess a lot. Like, Lord, I'm falling into this kind of consumeristic, materialist comparison trap. And I don't want to be there. So that was maybe the longest term shock that I had to deal with for the most amount of time.
Talking about being sort of forced into adulthood in the United States, I have panic attacks regularly. We have teens here who start talking about those kinds of things, you know, reverse mortgages and stuff. And I have no idea what they're talking about because I left at, you know, right after I finished graduate school at 27 and I've never bought a house in the United States or any of that kind of stuff. And so I don't know how any of that stuff works. You know, and I get asked often if I think we'll ever move back to the United States. I want to be like, I don't know how to.
It's too late now.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we're too far gone. We're just stuck here forever, which is okay. Yeah, and that's funny. I mean, you have affirmed all of my worst fears. It's a scary thought. So I've spent time thinking about the things that you actually had to wade through and survive and get to the point where you guys are thriving. I'm thankful for that.
I'll say one thing there, and this may interest somebody at some point. The fact that we were invited by the Methodist Church of Costa Rica to an open-ended commitment means that we avoided what is maybe the more standard missionary experience, which is where you're sent by a border agency. I mean, I knew folks, when we moved to San Jose, we met a lot more U.S. missionaries. And there were folks who every 3 years, their board called them back to the States for a year to do fundraising. And I thought, good grief, like at 3 years, you barely got credibility. Like the locals are barely taking you seriously. And now you're just going to disappear to Oz. And then, you know, your whole life, your kids, whatever. And then you come back after a year. So I realized that maybe that's a more traditional mission fundraising way of doing it. But it did at least give you this kind of regular exposure to U.S. culture for a year at a time or 6 months at a time. We never took a furlough. I don't think y'all have taken too many things that you could call a traditional furlough. So, I mean, you really are heavily enculturated in Costa Rican culture to the point where there are a lot of things about contemporary American culture that are simply foreign.
Yeah, I think because of our proximity, we're back and forth enough. Like, I mean, we're dipping our toes in the water on a regular basis, me more than the rest of my family because I go back to visit churches so often. But I think even for Yolanda and Isabella, like, I don't know which is better. I don't know. It was the only time we went back to the United States for an extended period was in 2007. And we were there for about 10 months and it felt way too long. It was such a disruption to all the momentum that we had built up by then. And I had kind of been led to believe that, you know, well, you've been there for 4 years, it's time to come home and do that thing. And I wonder how many of the people who are convinced that's a good idea have actually ever been full-time in the mission field, because it was such a disruption to put everything ministerially and personally, the life that we were building here, to put it on hold for that amount of time and then come back again and try and pick back up again. And just, there's a reason why we've never done that again. So we choose to do short visits on a much more regular basis. But I still don't know how helpful that would be if we did wind up for some reason having to go back to the States for a long period of time again. I'm not sure there's a way to make that easy.
Well, you were called back you did come back for a reason. And was the reason to be the director of the Wesley Heritage Foundation?
It was. At the end of 2019, so right before COVID, our son had just turned one. So we have much older daughters. We adopted our daughters while we were living there. We met them at the Methodist Children's Home, which was a ministry that my wife was the co-director of for a while. So they were 11 and 4 when they came to us. And then years later, is a kind of divine joke, God gave us a baby boy. So our son had just turned 1. And my wife, she's always more spiritually sensitive than I am. She picks up signals on her antenna more quickly than I do. She said, we've been here a while, 15, 16 years. Maybe it's time to go back. Our parents are getting older. And so we decided right before COVID that 2020 would be our last year, that we would take it through the end of 2020. But before we finally made that decision, I called a friend of mine, a minister in North Carolina, who had founded the Wesley Heritage Foundation with his own father in the mid-90s. And I can talk about that in a second. But we had done some work for them in the past, and he was getting a little older. And I said, if we were to move back, could I have some role with the foundation? I need a job. And he said, yes, I want you to be the director because I'm ready to retire. When I say director, it's a one person position. So it's like director / janitor of the Wesley Heritage Foundation. So I knew that I was coming back into that role. And I can talk about the foundation for a second briefly, just to explain kind of what it does. So
yeah.
In the mid-80s, mid to late 80s, there was a lot of connections between Methodists in North Carolina and Peru. And some folks were down. The Methodist Church of Peru is very old. And some folks were in the seminary library and realized there was almost no John Wesley. There was almost nothing by John Wesley in the library of the Methodist Seminary of Peru. And they spoke with the Peruvians and they said, no, it's just kind of whatever the missionaries have told us John Wesley is. You know, we've got maybe 30 sermons, but nobody really reads them. So Mark Wethington and his father, Albert, got a bunch of money together. They got Justo Gonzalez, the famous Cuban theologian and historian, to be the general editor. In the late 90s, they knocked out 14 volumes of John Wesley in Spanish, the Obras de Wesley, and started publishing that in the early 2000s. And that was just a huge before and after moment. Even at our seminary in Costa Rica, professors who were there before the works of Wesley showed up in Spanish and after, say it was just like a whole bunch of floodlights coming on, because now people could engage with their own story. They could engage with their own theological heritage in their own language. They didn't need some gringo to tell them what John Wesley said. They could read it. They could read it for themselves. So the foundation grew over the years and branched off more into even translation of contemporary works, online teaching, things like that. And that's where I had gotten involved while we were still in Costa Rica. So we came back at the end of 2020, and I was kind of given the task of kind of Wesley Heritage Foundation 2.0, sort of growing this legacy, spreading it a little further and making it even more responsive to Spanish-speaking leaders today.
Beautiful. I was actually thinking about you, Will, when I was in Panama last week, because that was a topic that we had talked a lot about, was how much the new pastors that are being trained up as church planters, and what is their experience with John Wesley, and how Wesleyan does their school of ministry and whatnot go. And so we were talking a lot about you last week, Luciano and I were.
Will, is it through partnerships that, how are you getting now the materials that you guys are providing? Do people just call you and say, hey, we'd like for our church to have such and such? Or are you going to conferences? Like, what is the sort of day-to-day, how are you promoting this?
Yeah, it's a bit of both. So we, 2 years ago, we digitized the Obras years ago and put them up online as a free download. And I mean, literally every day of the week, 2 or 3 people around the world are downloading the Obras de Wesley from our website without us doing much promotion or advertisement at all. I mean, people in the Spanish speaking world, the US, Latin America, Europe, are just going to Google and saying, you know, Juan Wesley en Español or Sermones de Juan Wesley, and they're finding us. So part of it is that, just a kind of a natural desire among a lot of Spanish speaking folks to engage with that tradition. A couple of years ago, we did a complete second edition, a complete review of the 14 volumes, and we put them in print again. So now we've got these beautiful 14 volumes set in print. And so we'll sell a lot of those. We'll get U.S. churches to buy a set and then donate those to maybe a partner church they have. Like, say they're going on a mission trip to Costa Rica or Colombia, and they'll take a couple sets of the Obras in their luggage. But we've also translated a lot of contemporary books from English to Spanish that we think would be very relevant. So books on church planting in the Wesleyan tradition, books on evangelism, books on female leadership, books in on the market that we think would be very useful for our audience. And so we translate and we sell those as well. But then training is a lot of what we've really leaned into. We kind of sit between the seminary and the local church. So we're not a seminary. We never plan to be one. But we want to come alongside seminaries and maybe help them reach actual, again, my first love is lay education. I mean, go back to our first couple of years in Southern Costa Rica, just equipping lay people who already have said, yes, Lord, I want to serve. And then giving them practical tools, not theoretical tools, but practical tools they can use. That's our real calling. So we publish, but then we also do a lot of custom training. And so that could be me on a Zoom call with 20 Nazarene district superintendents from Guatemala. That could be me in person in Houston, Texas, or Alpharetta, Georgia, preaching to a Hispanic congregation and then doing kind of a brown bag workshop after. So it can be in person, it can be virtual, it can be small groups, large groups. But getting you to read a book is great, but it's so much more effective if I can sit down with you, we can sit down with you and dig through this text and see how it really applies and then hear from you about what the challenges you're facing in your local church.
And this is exactly how you and I got connected. So in my role here, Will Bailey, I have the Woodlands Methodist Church mission pastor hat, but then I also have the Trinity Conference of the Global Methodist Church International Ministries chair hat. And in that hat, or under that hat, or with that hat, or with the hat, right on, with that hat, we have our partner conference in Panama. And one of the things that Luciano, who's the conference superintendent, he and I have been talking about, how do we effectively train his pastors? How do we effectively train his lay leaders? So my friend John Robert was working with the Wesley House of Ministry at Truett Seminary, and he was talking about different ways that we could effectively resource the Panama conference and the education that they're doing. And I believe he's the one that initially reached out to you, Will Faircloth. And because of that, we started talking and getting together to talk about how we could effectively resource the Panama conference and the training that they're doing.
Yeah. And that's exactly the kind of situation where we like to come in if we're invited, because we're the benefit of our name is that it's the Wesley Heritage Foundation. So we work a lot with the Free Methodist Church. We work a lot with the Wesleyan Church USA and the Wesleyan Church Latin America. We've done some stuff with the Church of the Nazarene, obviously the United Methodist Church, and now the Global Methodist Church. So we really have the benefit, although we certainly get some of the blowback, but we kind of sit over these different denominational silos because we're just trying to connect Spanish-speaking leaders with practical resources. And so it doesn't really matter, you know, kind of what the Anglo name for that is. But so we've experienced a lot of growth with the GMC in the last year or so, and the relationship with Truett and the Wesley House of Studies there, but also the way that the Wesley House of Studies is trying to help the Texas Conference, which is obviously a very Latino-heavy conference. And so there's just this gap. There are a lot of great leaders, and there's a lot of goodwill from above. But like, what would actually train these people look like? Where could we get some guidance? And where could we find some trustworthy resources? And so that's where we've been grateful to kind of be one of the people stepping in to say, okay, we've got trustworthy resources. We've got kind of bicultural understanding. How can we help you avoid some mistakes? And how can we help you launch this well?
And those are the two hats that you wear, Will, because you also wear two hats. You have the Wesley Heritage Foundation hat, and you have the Wesley House of Studies Truett Seminary Spanish Director hat.
That's exactly right. Or sombreros, if you will.
Thank you for
that. I did that for my 17-year-old daughter, who's not even present. That was just a good dad joke. But yeah, so since early June, I've taken on a kind of consultancy role with the Wesley House of Studies, because they saw a need both for their own seminary, Truett Seminary at Baylor University, but also for their role as kind of helping the GMC in Texas, but also Panama and Mexico. They saw a need to kind of pilot some education programs in Spanish. And so a few of us taught some courses back in the spring. And then I kind of came on in a kind of quarter part-time role in the summer to keep teaching at a lay education level, but certification level, but also help them kind of envision what bigger Hispanic and Latino-oriented programs could look like. And it's funny because it's a historically Baptist seminary. But the Wesley House within the seminary is only 5 years old, and it's already at, I think, 30% enrollment of the entire seminary. 30% of all Truett Seminary students are coming through the Wesley House of Studies. And that's
wow.
either certification or various master's degrees or the doctor of ministry. So it's really become a landing place for a lot of different types of Wesleyans. And obviously that includes folks that are doing ministry in Spanish, or could include those folks. And that's where we're trying to reach out more.
Well, I'm pretty sure the Woodlands Methodist Church is sending over half of the students. So they're
back. It's a good Woodlands contingent at Truett.
So, all right, just to do it, because I know probably where the majority of our listeners are coming from, but not all of them. What's a Wesleyan?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So the first class I taught down in San Isidro, down in El Peje del Volcán, was Methodist doctrine. And I had graduated from a Methodist seminary. I've been a United Methodist my whole life. And I had to ask another seminary professor, what does it mean to be a Wesleyan Methodist, so that I can turn around and teach these people? Because and I say this with love, but the brand of American Methodism long ago stopped needing to be Wesleyan. So you can belong to the brand called Methodism in America without really knowing anything about John Wesley. And that's sort of okay for the man. You don't really need to know the man. I don't really care so much about that. But what Wesley represents is a practical toolkit for cradle-to-grave discipleship, which really just means growing to be more like Jesus every day. So to be a Wesleyan first means to take your own need seriously. I've got, whatever, 3 cars, a house on the lake. I mean, I don't, but one does. But I'm still a sinner in need of grace. Like being good people just isn't enough. This is Wesley's sermon, the almost Christian. To say, well, he's a good dude, or she's a good gal, that's just not enough, right? I mean, you're in need. You're in need of grace. Second, it means to take Jesus very seriously as a savior, which I think a lot of us do, especially kind of in quasi-Baptist circles. Sure, he's a savior. But especially to take him seriously as Lord. Like, Jesus makes claims on my life. He wants to get up all in my business. He wants to be in my bank account. He wants to be in my browser history. He wants to be in my relationships with my children. He wants to be in the way I talk to other people behind the wheel. Like, he is the Lord of my life. And that's where Wesley really saw a deficit. And you could still say you see that deficit today. So how do I live out Jesus being the Lord? Well, I need other people. So the other main element of being Wesleyan is banding together. You need accountability groups, small groups, accountability relationships, whatever you want to call it. We love. Methodists love that famous phrase, the gospel knows no holiness but social holiness. And we like that because we think it's about social justice. But when Wesley wrote that, he was writing it in the context of individual Christians, people who thought me and Jesus could do it together. And he says, no, we need each other. There is no such holiness but communal holiness. So I think on the spot, it'd be those three things. It'd be taking your need, your daily need for grace and mercy seriously. Second, it'd be taking Jesus seriously as both Savior and Lord. And third, actively being part of some level of community that is helping me grow to be more like Jesus. Been doing this work for the last 5 or 10 years, that's where I've kind of landed. And you don't have to know John Wesley, the guy, but if you take those three things seriously and you're doing him, you are a Wesleyan.
That was beautiful, Will.
Yeah. Thank you for doing that, for teaching for a moment. Appreciate it. So I can sort of see, I think in my mind, the answers to this question, but I'd like to know how do you see, or have there been moments where doing what you're doing now, you can look back to those 16 years that you were here and go, oh, that's why I had to learn that lesson, or that's why I had that experience with that person. I mean, it seems to me like your experience here in Christian education obviously is a treasure trove of worth for what you're doing now. But I'm just curious, have there been moments that where it's sort of, you just realize, yep, that was part of the plan?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think a lot on the syllabus, the piece of paper I'd hand out at the start of class, I would put my cell phone number, but not my home phone number, because I would say, I don't want you calling me at night. This is back when people had home phones. But I would get calls at 11 o'clock at night on my cell phone from a student, and it wouldn't be about an assignment. It would be about, and these were all student pastors, right? So these were men and women who were already serving local churches. They were taking the brunt of everything that goes on in a local church, and they often had very few people to turn to. So our seminary weeks would often turn into group therapy sessions because they would just be able to pour their hearts out to other student pastors who got it and who weren't going to judge them. But sometimes they would call me, and I'm sure they called other professors too. And they would just be pouring their hearts out. They'd be having some difficulty. And I would honestly be thinking, I'm really tired. Like, I would just like to be in bed. Like, can you please call me tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock? And it didn't happen all the time, but it happened enough. But the Holy Spirit never let me just put my email address on the syllabus. Like, I had to put a phone number. And when I look back, I think, yeah, that was probably just to teach me that being in a community is messy. And you think when you're sharing about your problems that the other person is just super stoked to be hearing that. Maybe they just want to go back to bed, right? But they're there for you. And so if people are coming to me, if they're honoring me with this sort of confession or this sort of cry for help, then at the very least, I just need to be present and try to offer the best kind of comfort and counsel that I can. And so I think it taught me something about just when you're in a community, you don't get to set a lot of the rules, right? I mean, you show up for people, they show up for you, and then you just work it out on a case-by-case basis.
Sounds a lot like abiding.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're just there. You're just with people. And there's no way around it. And there's no way to be with Jesus without being with people. And I mean, Jesus had the dumbest apostles. I mean, they were almost as dumb as we are as disciples. But, you know, he's saying things like, can you drink this out of this cup that I'm going to drink from? They're like, yeah, that's awesome. Or like, hey, when you come back in glory, can we be at your left hand or right? I mean, they're having these power struggles, this pettiness, this incomprehension. That's just us. That's just us. And you can't be with Jesus without being with people.
So true. That'll preach somewhere, Will. Henry Nouwen's my favorite, and he always talks about the ministry of presence and what it means, our gift of time that we give to others, because God has been so freely, free and gracious with his time with us. And so how beautiful it is that we can mirror him in the way that we treat others by being present with them.
I like that a lot. And that's where, like, so coming back to the States, this maybe is a callback to one of your first questions, Will. Our home church during our 16 years in Costa Rica, one of our kind of two commissioning churches, we tried in 2021, our first year back, to really get reconnected. I mean, it was still COVID year. We had a toddler. We were getting, you know, it was a weird year, but maybe two or three Sundays a month we were there. By the end of the year, we just weren't feeling connected. And we didn't know a lot of people. There'd been a lot of generational turnover. And some friends were planting a church. And in January of 22, our second year back, they said, why don't you just come to this kind of like beta launch of this new worship service? We'll see what happens. And we did. And we left that worship service. And Ella, again, just so wise, we both loved it. We didn't even take the kids. We just went to check it out one evening. She said, our kids need to see us committed to a church. And again, I mean, in Latin America, there are lots of churches everywhere, but it's certainly not like there's one in every corner. And so in a lot of the U.S., maybe especially in the Southeast, you know, you can go to a different church in your town and never go to the same church twice in a year. And I'm not saying you can't change churches or whatever, but like, there's something to just saying, I'm going to be with these people. It's not going to be perfect all the time. You know, it's like a marriage. I'm not going to be a great spouse to this church all the time, but I'm just going to commit. I'm just going to be here. And so for the last 4 years, if we're in town, we're in that church. And it's been great for all of us just to say, we're here. These are our people, good or bad.
So what's next, Will? What's exciting you most about this next season with the institutions you lead, Wesley House of Studies at Truett or with Wesley Heritage Foundation?
Well, I am excited about the work out at Truett. It's a great institution. I mean, there's several great, you know, Methodist Wesleyan seminaries in the U.S., but this one is just new and it's fresh and it's open-eyed. They're trying not to make mistakes and they're really being generous in a lot of ways. And so I'm excited to see as we grow, finding Latino Hispanic pastors in the U.S. who maybe are doing their best right now and don't maybe feel a lot of support. And so I'm excited to kind of grow a place where they can say, hey, we're actually ready to pour into you. Like, we see and affirm the work you're already doing. We want to pour into you. So that's an exciting thing to be at the start of. And then our sort of main ministry, the Wesley Heritage Foundation, The network just keeps growing. That's the beauty of being kind of pan-Wesleyan. So, I mean, we're in conversations with the largest Spanish-speaking Pentecostal church in Queens about coming alongside their training academy and kind of bringing some Wesley-specific topics into the way they train their leaders. And that just started because a guy who was going to be a professional soccer player in Chile and tried out for an MLS team in New Jersey and didn't make it and stayed to run an ice cream shop, but is also like an amateur theologian. He just wrote me out of the blue and said, can I connect you with our pastor and the head of our academy and stuff? So the way the Holy Spirit is just bringing these connections, and really it's exciting for me to see, especially moving into the next year, where I would love to bring our kind of main Free Methodist partners together with our main Wesleyan Church USA partners, together with maybe some Global Methodist, United Methodist partners, because these folks have way more in common as Spanish-speaking Wesleyans than they do that divides them. And so we would love to start maybe hosting some roundtables or just some sort of leader gatherings to really, because connectionalism obviously is the heart of being a Wesleyan. And so maybe gathering around some of our own resources or topics of their own choosing, but I think I'd love next year for us to kind of take these contacts we have up into a new gear.
So exciting.
A lot of it's just seeing what the Holy Spirit wants to do. I mean, I've got a whole whiteboard full of stuff, and then it's like, okay, well, where's funding going to come from, and what pieces are going to fall into place? And Holy Spirit, just sort of have us be ready when it does fall into place.
See, I can't have that on my whiteboard because I don't want to be reminded of that stuff constantly. What's on my whiteboard right now is fifth grade science. We've got parallel circuits, in series circuits, magnets, alternating current, direct current. That's what's on.
No, I'm
on my whiteboard.
I'm with you. But if I don't write it down, then I won't remember it. And then if I'm in a conversation and the moment is there, then I can mention it. We'll see what happens. But yes, we're also making sure we have the right cleats for soccer practice this afternoon.
Yeah.
Well, y'all have done a great job like handling this interview because I've been over here blowing my nose every 5 minutes and
the Lord knew.
Expectorating. The Lord knew. Yes. Praise God.
Well, it's great to see you again, Will, and to catch up with you, Ashley. Thank you for putting this together. I'm sorry it wasn't the surprise that you wanted it to be, but it's been great to see Will and to get caught up on everybody. We miss you around here, but we're really, really proud of what you guys are doing there and know that the Methodist Church of Costa Rica still feels very connected to you and your family and are so thankful for the amount of time and energy and just life that you invested in them for so long and continue to. So I'll speak on behalf of the church for a minute just to thank you for that.
Well, that's very
good to see you.
That's very kind. It's really good to see you too. Thank you all very much for having me.
Ashley?
Will Bailey.
Doing this again soon, right?
I think
next
so.
Week, or week after next.
Like week after.
All right. Will, great to see you. Thanks for joining us. Ashley, good to see you too.
Bye, Will. Bye, Will.
Thanks. Bye.
You've been listening to The Broken Banquet, a podcast by Will Bailey and Ashley Goad. Music provided by Irene and the Sleepers. Join us next week for another episode. He's prepared the table. All things are ready. Come to the feast.